to look at Obadiah then, and just a quick summary of what we're going to do. One is that Obadiah means servant of Yah, but it's really a prophecy against Edom. We've already seen from Amos yesterday that Amos was a prophecy against certain nations, and other minor prophets are also prophecies against, you know, some of the nations that attacked Israel. But Obadiah specifically is against Edom. We'll see that there's always sort of been really a perpetual hatred between Esau and Edom, but really after the destruction of Edom as a nation, that sort of hatred was sort of transposed really onto the nations. There is a view that Edom is the Arabs, but we'll look into why that, I don't think that is the case. So briefly, it'll help if we have a look at the history of Edom, just sort of remind ourselves in Genesis that hatred and bitterness that Esau traditionally had against Edom. So if you just take a trip down memory lane really, and just turn back to Genesis in chapter 25. Esau was Jacob's brother. His name really comes from the same root as red, Adam, or also sin. You know, red and sin are really symbolic of being the same thing in scripture, and Edom is that same colour really, sin or red. His name, other name is Esau, which is, means hairy, and again the idea of hair, sort of like a goat in scripture, is always a sort of bad thing really. So everything about Esau's name is telling us that it's something bad, either, you know, sinful, etc. And the sort of characteristics of Edom were that he, you know, he was brought up in tents along with Jacob, with Isaac, and yet he completely rejected the truth. He had absolutely no interest at all in the things of the scripture. He could hardly imagine anyone more disinterested, and yet they were both sort of brought up in the same environment. If you go to Genesis chapter 25 and verse 34, just the last verse of that chapter, this is when Jacob has made him give up his birthright. And that last verse, verse 34, then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drank, and he rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. It probably doesn't quite come across in English as it does in Hebrew, because in Hebrew it's really very short, sharp words and phrases. It says, he ate, he drank, he rose, he went, and he despised his birthright. It really is just like that. In 2 or 3 minutes, his whole birthright was gone. He had absolutely no interest in it. As far as he was concerned, it was just a piece of meat, and that was all he was doing. He had zero interest in the things of the truth. If you turn over a couple of chapters later to Genesis chapter 27 and verses 19 and 20, this is when, you know, Jacob is just about to bless Esau. And Jacob said unto his father, I am Esau, thy firstborn. I have done according as thou badest me. Arise, I pray thee, sit and eat of my venison, that my soul may bless thee. And so Isaac said unto his son, how is it that thou hast found it so quickly, my son? And he said, because Yahweh thy Elohim brought it to me. So Esau has come in from hunting. So if you look at the words he uses, why have you done this so quickly? Because Yahweh, your Elohim, brought it to me. As far as Esau is concerned, this isn't his God, it's Jacob's God, it's somebody else's God. He is zero interested in the things of the truth. He doesn't even think God is any relevant to him. And that's, you know, the way it comes across really. Then we turn later on in that chapter to verses 35 and 36 when he realises he's been not exactly conned by Jacob, because Jacob had legitimately got the birthright from him. He was not only spiritually the best, but even sort of humanly speaking, he'd already bought the birthright from Esau. But when Esau realises he's sort of lost out on that, verses 35 and 36, thy brother came with subtlety and hath taken away thy blessing. Then Esau's angry, and he said, is not he rightly named Jacob, or supplanter? For he hath supplanted me these 2 times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he hath taken away my blessing. And he said, hast thou not reserved a blessing for me? And so he has sort of crocodile tears really when he realises that he's missed out on something that he might otherwise have got. Verse 38, and Esau said unto his father, hast thou got one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. So he was just bitter and crying that he had missed out on this. And yet that's actually picked up in the New Testament. So for example, in Hebrews chapter 12, I'll just read it to you. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person, as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For you know how that afterwards, how he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. He couldn't really care about the blessing, he had no interest in it. Just for a plate of soup, he sold his whole birthright. But he did have sort of crocodile tears when he realised he had missed out on something. This is how, you know, the divine record, that's what he says, is a fornicator, a profane person who is no interested in things of the truth. And yet, he goes on to have really quite bitter hatred against Jacob. So reading in verse 39 of that chapter, Genesis 27. And Isaac his father answered and said unto him, Behold, thy dwelling shall be with the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. And by thy sword shalt thou live, and shalt serve my brother. And it shall come to pass, when thou shalt have the dominion, that thou shalt break his yoke from off thy neck. And so there will come a time, or there would come a time, when Edom would break the yoke off Jacob and have the mastery over Jacob, which happens in Obadiah's prophecy, as will happen, as we'll see. And then in verse 41, And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, The days of mourning for my father are at an end. Then will I slay my brother Jacob. And these words of Esau, her elder son, were told to Rebekah. And so Jacob has to flee away, which is how he ends up in Padan Aram, etc., and how he marries Rachel. But Esau has that burning hatred, kind of down through the centuries, I suppose. There is a time when he temporarily makes up with Jacob, you know, when Jacob does come back from Padan Aram, and, you know, in chapter 33, they do sort of temporarily make up. Other than that sort of one time, you know, that family going through sons and daughters and, you know, decade after decade, they had that bitter hatred towards Jacob, the fact that Jacob got the blessing. And, you know, the divine record, Romans chapter 9, as it is written, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. And that's quoting from Malachi chapter 1. And we've read already that Hebrews 12, again the divine record, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright, and he, you know, wanted it afterwards. So to sum up the sort of character of Edom, although he is Jacob's brother, and although he was brought up in tents dwelling alongside Isaac and Jacob, he had no interest in the things of the truth. He despised spiritual things. He took no interest in God at all. He was jealous of his brother who got the blessing. He had crocodile tears when he realised the blessing had been given to someone else. And he harboured that perpetual hatred of Jacob down through the centuries. Also remember, not so long after that, when Jacob, or Israel I suppose, was going to enter into the promised land, having been in the wilderness for 40 years, he wanted to pass through the land of Edom, their own brother's land, in order to get into the promised land, and Edom won't let them. Just reading from, if you turn briefly to Numbers chapter 20. So when Israel simply wants to go through the land of Edom to get into the land of Israel, reading from verses 17 to 21, it says, Let us pass, I pray thee, through thy country. We will not pass through the fields, we won't go through the vineyards, neither will we drink of the water of the wells. We'll go by the king's highway, which is the trade route that everyone was going to go through. Everyone going from east to west and west to east went through the king's highway. So all they wanted to do is go through the king's highway like anyone else. We won't turn to the right hand nor to the left until we've passed thy borders. That's a perfectly reasonable request. And Edom said unto him, Thou shalt not pass by me, lest I come out against thee with the sword. And the children of Israel said unto him, No, we will go by the highway, and if my cattle drink of thy water, then we'll pay for it. I will only, without doing anything else, go through in my feet. In other words, just simply going to walk through, go through the king's highway. If somebody did end up drinking your water, you know, we'll pay you for it, etc. And Edom said, Thou shalt not go through. And Edom came out against him with much people. and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border, whereof Israel turned away from him. And so they attacked Israel, their own brother, who were simply going to go through the king's highway, just like any other traveller. Jephthah, later on in Judges, knows this history very well. And when Edom wants their land back, Jephthah says, you know, then Israel, this is Judges chapter 11, then Israel sent messengers unto the king of Edom, saying, let me, I pray thee, pass through thy land. This is Jephthah explaining to the king of Edom what happened. But the king of Edom would not hearken thereto, and in like manner they sent unto the king of Moab, but he would not consent, and Israel abode in Kadesh. Then he went along through the wilderness, and compassed the land of Edom, and the land of Moab, and came by the east side of the land of Moab, and pitched on the other side of Arnon. So Jephthah explains, hundreds of years later, Israel still knows their history. They still remember that Edom would not let them pass through the land. And so that bitter hatred against Jacob kind of perpetuates down through the centuries. And so if we come to Obadiah's prophecy now, we can see it in a little bit more of the context. So this is now really taking us now back to the time of Nebuchadnezzar, when Nebuchadnezzar was conquering Jerusalem, and that perpetual hatred between Esau, Edom, and their brother Jacob again surfaced, just like it had when Israel wanted to go through the land, etc. And so, you know, Nebuchadnezzar is now coming up against Jerusalem, but Edomites are now actually helping Nebuchadnezzar along. They're doing some terrible, terrible things, which we'll go through, just to see what exactly they were doing. If we go to verse 10, for thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. Very important word. So that hatred between Jacob and his brother had resurfaced again, and when Nebuchadnezzar was attacking Babylon, they actually helped Nebuchadnezzar. They made sure that there was no one to escape the violence of Nebuchadnezzar. And so in verse 11, in the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers, the Babylonians, carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. So Nebuchadnezzar was now ransacking Jerusalem. Foreigners who had, you know, a completely different ethnic group were entering into Jerusalem. That was the one time when that, you know, brotherly love should perhaps have realised that they shouldn't have been allowing that, and yet Edom was actually allowing that, and actually egging Nebuchadnezzar on, making sure that, you know, watching these foreigners from thousands of miles away coming into Jerusalem and carrying away captive their own brother, in effect. In verse 12, that thou shouldest not have looked on the day of thy brother, in the day that he became a stranger. Neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Neither shouldest thou have spoken proudly in the day of distress. So we see there that when Nebuchadnezzar is looting and pillaging Jerusalem, you know, taking people captive back to Babylon with them, the Edomites are right there. You know, they're watching all this happen. They're actually rejoicing in verse 12 over this, watching Judah being taken away into captivity. They've spoken proudly, you know, they're saying things like, you know, well, look what's happening to them, etc. They're gloating over the fact that they're not being conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, and they're actually rejoicing over Jerusalem in the day of Israel's, or Judah's distress. In verse 13, it gets even worse. Thou shouldest not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. And now they're actually going into Jerusalem and looting along with the Babylonians. Yea, thou shouldest not have looked on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor have laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. So just as the Babylonians are looting and pillaging, the Edomites are also doing the same thing. But again, it gets even worse. In verse 14, neither shouldest thou have stood on the crossway to cut off those of his that did escape, neither shouldest thou have delivered up those of his that did remain in the day of distress. What the Edomites were doing is, if you know, can imagine if there's an army besieging you, some people would manage to kind of escape from the city to try to get away, to crossways in the road, any way you could escape whatsoever from the pillaging. The Edomites are actually standing around Jerusalem, making sure that nobody escapes. And if any Israelites did escape, they were making sure that they were delivered into the Babylonians to be killed. It was an awful, awful thing to do. And in verse 15, "For the day of the Lord is near upon all heathen. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head." The things that Edom were doing was just really terrible. They were helping Nebuchadnezzar to loot and pillage. They were making sure that, you know, no one escaped. And if anyone did escape, they were either killing them themselves or delivering them off to Nebuchadnezzar to be killed. You know, just imagine how horrifying that would be. Women, children, men, everything. We're actually told, if you go back to Amos, which is actually just the previous prophet, and back to chapter 1 and verse 11, it says, "Thus saith Yahweh, for 3 transgressions of Edom, and for 4, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because he did pursue his brother with the sword, and did cast off all pity, and his anger did tear perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever." So that just sums up this bitter hatred that Edom had at this time towards Jacob. Here is Nebuchadnezzar, you know, ransacking and killing the people in Jerusalem. And he's pursuing his brother with a sword. He's making sure that nobody escapes from that destruction. He's casting off all pity, all sort of normal human compassion has been cast off. His anger to tear perpetually. He's got this sort of hatred, this sort of bee in his bonnet about Jacob still, and he kept his wrath forever. You know, hundreds and hundreds of years later, that same animosity is there. You can sort of imagine how animosity does run through a people years later, with perhaps the English versus the Scots and the Welsh and Irish. You know, people still hate people for what happened hundreds of years later. And that's what Edom is doing as a nation, perpetually maintaining that hatred, reminding their children of what Jacob did, they took away our birthright, etc. And so that hatred is still there. It's actually worse even than that, as if that wasn't bad enough. Nebuchadnezzar, if any of the Jews were in Gaza and Tyre, you know, north and Lebanon and south and Gaza, even they were being delivered to Edom to make sure that Edomites handed over to Nebuchadnezzar to be killed. So for example, if we just turn back to Amos chapter 1 and verse 6, it says, "Thus saith Yahweh, for 3 transgressions of Gaza and for 4, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they carried away captive the whole captivity to deliver them to Edom." So the people of Gaza were actually taking Israelites and handing them over to the Edomites to be killed or destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. You know, this is what the Edomites did. They were everywhere, they just helped. They were known that if you handed over Israelites to the Edomites, they'd be killed. Tyre were doing it as well. In verse 9, "Thus saith the Lord, for 3 transgressions of Tyre and for 4, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they delivered up the whole captivity to Edom, and remembered not the brotherly covenant." Remember, Edom was Jacob's brother. And as if that isn't bad enough, it gets even worse. So we turn to, keep your finger in Obadiah, but go back to Psalm 137. You get other little insight into just how bad it was for Israel in that day. Psalm 137. This is the one that starts, "By the rivers of Babylon." This is taken into captivity now. "There we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof." You know, they're lamenting the fact that they've been taken captive to Babylon. "For there they carried us away captive, required of us a song. And they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, Sing us one of the songs of Zion," which it was mocking Israel. Then it says in verse 7, even though this is the Babylonians really being addressed here, the psalm remembers what the Edomites did. "Remember, Yahweh, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof." In other words, the Edomites wanted Jerusalem just to be razed to the ground, to be completely flattened. not only ransacking, pillaging, etc. They were just begging the Babylonians just to destroy Jerusalem completely, just eradicate the Israelites, get rid of everything that Jacob is. And in verse 8, O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. That's what the Babylonians and Edomites were doing. They were taking little babies and smashing their heads really on rocks to kill them. It's really a sadistic level of violence. But that is what the Edomites were doing. They were, people were being delivered to the Edomites to make sure that they were being killed. So you can see that sort of level of hatred and barbarity is something that God will eventually destroy and condemn. And so that's where, the rest of Obadiah's prophecy comes in. That perpetual hatred that Edom had for his brother, casting off all pity, is now going to be, spoken against. So Edom as a nation, as an ethnic group, were going to be punished and permanently destroyed for the hatred of their brother Israel. And so if you just turn back to Obadiah and just look at verse 16. But as ye have drunk upon my holy mountains, so shall all the heathen drink continually. They shall drink and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been. And so Obadiah is prophesying that Edom will be destroyed as a nation. So we look back at verse 1, the vision of Obadiah. Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a rumour from Yahweh, an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise against her in battle. And so all that violence of Edom is now going to return upon their own head, and the nations are going to come against Edom for destruction this time, and no mercy will be given to them, just as they showed no mercy to the people of Jerusalem in that day. Verse 2, behold, I have made thee small among the heathen, thou art greatly despised. Edom, as we've seen, when the Israelites were trying to pass through the King's Highway to get into the land of Israel, Edom was on a major, highway really going from east to west and west to east. So anyone going to Babylon, etc., or down into Egypt, kind of had to go through that King's Highway. Although they were trivial and nothing as a nation, they were quite sort of well off financially and very influential. And so they're small among the heathen, but they're greatly despised. No one likes merchants that make money off everyone. In verse 3, the pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the cleft of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring thee down to the ground? And in Jordan, if you've been to Petra, Petra is a sort of city of the Edomites, a classic city, and it was where it used to be, where all the east-west traffic went. It takes, if you look at the guidebooks, it takes probably at least a week to get through Petra. It's like a big sort of lots and lots of cliff faces and houses in the cliffs, etc. And yet there's just absolutely nothing there today. Everything has been completely taken over and gone. So they dwelt in the clefts of the rock, high cliff faces, where they thought they were impregnable. It's all been completely and utterly taken away now. Verse 4, though thou exalt thyself as an eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith Yahweh. And in verse 5, if thieves came to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have left, would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some grapes? So if a nation is going to pillage and loot another nation, they would always leave something behind. It could be something that archaeologists would find, etc. Happened to Jerusalem many times, where despite invasion after invasion, there's lots left for archaeologists to find. Pottery, coins, etc. But it's saying here that the destruction and the plundering of Edom is going to be so intense that there's just nothing at all is going to be left behind. Thieves would leave something behind, and grape gatherers would leave something behind, and yet Edom is going to be completely and utterly emptied out. And to this day, Arabs think that whole area is haunted. They just don't go there at all, there's nothing left at all. In verse 6, how were the things of Esau searched out? How were his hiding places sought up? It was as if every single last stone was left not left uncovered. Everything was taken out. Like a thorough search of everything. Every corner, every house, just everything was completely and utterly ransacked. In verse 7, all the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. This is where Edom thought they were being very smart and clever. Remember, wisdom in Edom was meant to be this great, fantastic thing. You know, wisdom would perish from Teman. In the book of Job, all the sort of clever, smart people came from Teman, from the same area as Edom. They were meant to be very clever people. And so they thought they were being clever by siding with the Babylonians against Jerusalem. And that turned back on their own head. All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that are at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. It was meant to be the Edomites who were smart and clever. Turns out they weren't clever at all, and there's no understanding in them at all. In verse 8, shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Babylon, and understanding out of the mouth of Esau? And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. And so even as a nation we're going to be completely and utterly destroyed, no trace left for all the violence against their brother. If we just turn briefly to a couple of other prophets where we can just emphasise just how complete that destruction was going to be. And so we turn to Jeremiah chapter 49. Just a single verse from here. Jeremiah chapter 49 and verse 17. It says, and Edom shall be a desolation. Every one that goeth by it shall be astonished, and shall hiss at all the plagues thereof. So from that point on, Edom ceased to exist as a nation. It's going to be complete desolation, and everyone that goes by it is going to be astonished. There's just nothing left of them, and they're going to hiss at all the plagues thereof. If we turn to Ezekiel chapter 35, we just see a few more prophets as to what would happen to Edom. It says, chapter 35, in the first few verses, moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Mount Seir, which is Edom, meaning Heri, and prophesy against it, and say unto it, Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, Behold, O Mount Seir, I am against thee, and I will stretch out mine hand against thee, I will make thee most desolate. I will lay thy cities waste, and thou shalt be desolate, and thou shalt know that I am Yahweh. Because thou hast had a perpetual hatred, and to shed the blood of the children of Israel by the force of the sword in the time of their calamity, that's going back to the Babylonian things that happened then, as we've seen, in the time that their iniquity had an end. Therefore, as I live, saith Adonai Yahweh, I will prepare thee unto blood, and blood shall pursue thee. Because thou hast not hated blood, even blood shall pursue thee. Thus will I make Mount Seir most desolate, and cut off from it him that passeth out and him that returneth. And I will fill his mountains with his slain men. In thy hills and in thy valleys and in thy rivers shall they fall that are slain with the sword. I will make thee perpetual desolations, and thy cities shall not return, and he shall know that I am Yahweh. And so Edom as a nation was going to have perpetual desolations, and their cities wouldn't return. You know, they were never again going to become a nation again. They were going to become a perpetual waste. I'll just read you just one verse in Joel chapter 3 and verse 19. It says, Egypt shall be a desolation, and Edom shall be a desolate wilderness for the violence against the children of Judah, because they have shed innocent blood in their land. And so taken together, those prophecies mean that Edom was going to be completely destroyed, perpetual desolation, you know, for their cruelty against their brother Israel. Their cities were going to be destroyed and not return, and they themselves were going to have perpetual desolations. Actually, in a similar way, Moab and Edom were also going to be cut off for pretty much exactly the same reason. Just reading from Zephaniah, I have heard the reproach of Moab and the revilings of the children of Ammon when they have reproached my people and magnified themselves against their border. Therefore, as I live, saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab shall be as Sodom, and the children of Ammon as Gomorrah, even the breeding of nettles and salt pits and a perpetual desolation. The residue of my people shall spoil them, and the remnant of my people shall possess them. And also for Ammon, in Amos chapter 1, thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of the children of Ammon, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have ripped up the women with the child of Gilead, that they might enlarge their border. So Ammon, Moab, and Edom were all going to be perpetually destroyed for their violence against Israel and for their cruelty against their own brother, really. So we've seen then that historically Edom was Jacob's brother. He had zero interest in the things of the truth, even though he was brought up alongside Jacob and Isaac. He was jealous of his brother. He had this perpetual bitter hatred that just would not rest against his brother. Temporarily he did sort of make peace when Jacob returned, a very small window of time. Other than that, he just bitterly hated his brother. And even when Nebuchadnezzar was entering into Jerusalem in the day of their calamity, that's when the Edomites were giving up all these people to be killed and murdered, and all the other nations were giving them to the Edomites to be killed. So I want to just look at the sort of latter day Edomites, because although nationally and ethnically Edom was going to be destroyed as a perpetual desolation, it does sort of rise again in latter day prophecies. And so we need to understand what exactly is meant. There is a view amongst some Christadelphians, such as Harry Whittaker, and also the Williamsburg Christadelphian foundations, who are unamended, that the latter-day Edom is modern-day Arabs. And so that bitter hatred of Edom has kind of been taken over by the Arabs, and so the Arabs now hate Israel. And I suggest that that's not possible to equate the two like that, because as we've seen, Edom was destroyed as a nation. Several prophets together said it was going to be perpetual desolations. So if perpetual desolation and perpetual destruction doesn't mean perpetual destruction, then I don't know what it does mean. So that's not what the prophets say. But more than that, Edom as a nation can't really be the Arabs for several reasons. One is that they're ethnically not really related to the Arabs in general. Remember, the Arabs will always tell you that they're related to Ishmael. That's the other son of Isaac and Ishmael. Or that they're related directly coming from Abraham. But they're not related directly to Edom. So Arabs believe that they're related to Ishmael. Or at the very least, when Abraham, after the death of Sarah, when Abraham took other wives, the Arab tribes Mughal have come from them. Just very briefly, I'll just read you a few in Genesis chapter 10. And to Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder, even to him were children born. The children of Shem, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, Aram, and these are all sort of Arab type nations. Arphaxad began Salah, and Salah began Eber, and unto Eber there was Peleg, and another number of nations after that that were all where modern Arabs are, which is Sheba, Dedan, etc., and Ophir, Avilah. In Genesis 25, then again Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and she bare him Zimran, and Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Eshbak, and Shua. And Jokshan begat Sheba and Dedan, which are the classic Arab nations. And again, if you look at the ethnic diversity of those nations, either they're the modern Arabs are related to Ishmael, or really from Abraham directly, but they're not from Edom. Edom was just one ethnic group, very specific ethnic group, which were destroyed. And so ethnically you can't really say that modern day Arabs are descendants of Edom. They're much wider than that. Arabs themselves don't even say that, and Edom was destroyed as a nation. So instead we've got to understand that latter day prophecies about Edom transfer over to the nations it's the nations in general that are taking over that bitter hatred, and probably more specific than just any old nations, it's really the ones that in the latter day prophecies will attack Israel in the latter days, the sort of Ezekiel 38 type nation. And just to demonstrate that, if we turn to back to Obadiah, but also just on the way to Amos chapter 9. Amos chapter 9, we'll just read from verse 11 for context. "In that day when I raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen, and close up the breaches thereof, and I will raise up his ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom and of all the heathen which are called by my name, saith Yahweh that doeth this." So there, the remnant of Edom and the heathen in general, even the nations, the Goyim, those are kind of equated. Scripture itself is saying that Edom would sort of become, that bitterness would become the nations. And if you look to Obadiah in chapter 15 and 16, you can see that again, that Edom itself prophesies mutating from just specifically about Edom into prophecy and the nations around Israel in the wider context. So Obadiah in verses 15 and 16, "For the day of Yahweh is near upon all the heathen. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head." So that's specifically about Edom. But then verse 16, first of all in verse 15 it's thy, it's singular all the way throughout, so it's Edom as a nation. In verse 16, "For as ye," so it's now plural, "for as ye have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen," so it's equating Edom, it's now saying that hatred would transfer over to the nations in general. "So shall all the nations drink continually, yea, they shall drink, not just Edom now, but all the nations, and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they have not been." So the hatred that Edom had is now going on to the nations in general. So the nations have a historical role of hatred against Israel. Just as for a brief window of time, Esau kind of made friends with Jacob when he returned from Paddan Aram, you could say that the nations did that for a while, the United Nations, the one time when they finally agree on something, and they allowed Israel in 1948 to have the nation again. But other than that little brief window of time, the nations have always had this bitter hatred against, you know, Israel, against, you know, anti-Semitic, mortally anti-Semitic. The Catholic Church has always, from its inception, been fanatically anti-Semitic. They believe that Israel is a rival to them because they claim Jerusalem, so the Jews can't claim it. If you look at all the history of the nations, modern sort of European and Russian nations, there's always been a history of anti-Semitism and bitter, bitter, illogical hatred of Israel. You know, the Crusades, they started off killing Jews. Why go to the Holy Land when you've got Christ killers right here in Europe? You know, the Spanish Inquisition, huge numbers of Jews were killed. The Holocaust was a systematic attempt to eliminate Jews, and Protestants aren't much better. You know, Martin Luther was highly anti-Semitic, and all sort of modern Christianity, really, you know, replacement theology has taken all the blessings of Scripture that would refer to Israel and made them refer to Christians. You know, replaced Israel with you know, Christians, and all the condemnations go to Israel. You know, the Europeans are particularly bad for anti-Semitism. French, German, Spanish, you know, they all hate Israel. The Russians as well hate Israel. All the nations that will form the sort of latter-day Northern Confederacy against Israel all bitterly, bitterly hate Israel. You know, there is a chart that one of the historians did where it shows all the nations of Europe and the dates when Jews were expelled from all those countries. Country after country have expelled Jews because of that bitter hatred, you know, all independently for different reasons, etc. And so that hatred that Edom as a nation historically had is sort of transferred over to the nations. Just read you, this is something which Brother Thomas realised, and so just reading from Eureka, this is the first volume, you know, a little bit about the Apocalypse and all the prophets. Well, in the Apocalypse and Obadiah, he just says, "Edom, in the prophecies concerning the restoration of Israel's kingdom in the latter days, is representative of the enemies of Jacob, banded together under the guardianship of Gog, who was then the chief of the house of Esau. Obadiah had a vision of this confederacy, occupying a similar relationship to Israel hereafter that Edom did in the typical times of the prophet. Obadiah has placed on record the sentence that every one of the mount of Esau shall be cut off by slaughter forever, and shame shall cover them because of their violence against Jacob. But as Edom has drunk upon Yahweh's holy mountain, where also the rebel to this day, so shall the nations drink, and they shall be as though they have not been. For that upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and it shall be holy, and the house of Jacob shall possess the possessions, and the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, or as Paul styles it, the fire of flame, in Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 verse 8, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, and that at the time appointed for this, the deliverer shall come up in Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall thus be Yahweh's. And so he's taking these events that are described in the last few verses of Obadiah and understanding that it's not Edom as an ethnic group, but rather that bitter hatred was transferring over to the nations, who would then act as a confederacy, you know, the northern host, and attack Israel in that day. And just as Edom enjoyed the fact that Nebuchadnezzar was ransacking Jerusalem and egged them on and made sure that Jews were killed, that same pattern is going to be repeated when, you know, the northern confederacy invades Jerusalem, does exactly the same thing many hundreds and hundreds of years later. You know, the nations are going to be celebrating and gloating over that in the same way that Edom was. And Brother Thomas, in that paragraph, he quotes Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 8 as being a sort of embellished prophecy of Obadiah. I'll just read that for you. It's a verse that you probably just gloss over and not understand that it's taken from Obadiah. This is Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 8 to 10. It says, "In flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God, and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power, when he shall come to be glorified in the saints and to be admired in all them that believe, because our testimony among you was believed in that day." And so that passage about Christ coming is sort of picking up on Obadiah. And so the resurrected saints will fight against the latter day Edom, the nations, actually taking the same sort of route that the Israelites of old took when they left Egypt, went out through Sinai and into the promised land. You know, they received the law at Mount Sinai and then inherited the went into the land. And we also will kind of receive a five-year law, in the words of Deuteronomy chapter 33, and then we'll enter the promised land, conquering all those nations that stand against Christ and the saints. There is a verse, I'll just do a quick quote from Eureka, then we'll look at the last few verses of Obadiah to understand the events that will happen in the latter days. Just reading from volume 5 of Eureka, about the second angel in Revelation 16. It says, this is quoting from Obadiah, "Thus, on returning home from their dispersion, after they stand upon their feet as a great army, they will have to fight their way through all the countries of the house of Esau." In other words, not obviously literal Edom, but the nations that have now formed that northern confederacy. "In this jubilee return, under the second and third angels, the house of Jacob," says Obadiah, "shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for a stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour in them." That's picking up in the Thessalonians quote. "And there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau. Their saviours shall come up on Mount Zion, the Lamb of the 144,000, to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be Yahweh's. In this way, Babylon and the goat nations are made to drink of the wine of the wrath of the deity, prepared without mixture in the cup of his indignation. Esau will have had the dominion over Jacob long enough, and the time will now have arrived to prove to mankind that there is a God that judgeth in the earth. Esau has lived by his sword," a quote from earlier, "but not righteously. He crucified the king of Israel, persecuted and killed his brethren, corrupted the faith, trod underfoot the holy city 42 months, and poured out the blood of Jacob like water upon the ground. But they who war against Zion and her sons shall be as nothing, as a thing of naught. Therefore, fear not, thou worm Jacob, and ye men of Israel. I will help thee, saith Yahweh, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I will make thee a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth. Thou shalt thrash the mountains or empires, and beat them small. Thou shalt make the hills or smaller states as chaff. Thou shalt fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them. And thou shalt rejoice in Yahweh, and shall glory in the Holy One of Israel. This has never come to pass since it was recorded by the prophet, for hitherto Jacob has been under the heel of Esau, whose metallic image stands unbroken under its feet of iron and miry clay. The work of the second and third angels is to grind to powder the various metals of which it is composed, and to do the work so effectually that no place be found for the things they represent. That's taking those last few verses in Obadiah that we'll just look at now, and making sure that we understand that those refer to the, you know, to the confederacy who would attack Israel. So jumping to verse 16, for as ye have drunk upon my holy mountains, so shall all the nations drink continually. You know, that vengeance against Jerusalem, against Israel, anti-Semitism will be returned on their own head. In verse 17, that upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. So the Gogian host will invade Israel, you know, Ezekiel 38 and passages like that. And then Zechariah chapter 12 will happen, when Israel will be saved from the Gogian host, and although they suffer badly, as Israel of old did when Nebuchadnezzar invaded, you know, he will at that time recognize their Messiah. Just keep the finger there, but just remind ourselves in Zechariah chapter 12 of that. Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 6 to 10. In that day shall I make the governors of Judah like a fire of heart among the wood. Again, that same imagery of fire amongst stubble, you know, the stubble of the nations. And like a torch of fire in a sheaf. And they shall devour all the people, all the nations round about, on the right hand and on the left. And Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. Yahweh also shall save the tents of Judah first, and let the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. In that day shall Yahweh defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them at that day shall be as David, and the house of David shall be as God, as the angel of Yahweh before them. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplications. They shall look upon him whom they have pierced, and shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be ambitionous for him as one which is ambitionous for his son. So that is sort of happening, I suppose, in verse 17 of Obadiah. And so in verse 18, you know, in the house of Jacob shall be a fire, that's what we've seen in Zechariah, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for Yahweh hath spoken it. So all the remnant of the Jews outside of Israel will fight their way through the nations, and they'll do valiantly, not by human strength alone, but this time with the help of the multitudinous Christ. In verse 19, and they of the south shall possess the mount of Esau, and they of the plain the Philistines, and they shall possess the fields of Ephraim and the fields of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead. You know, Israel is going to come back to their to the greater land again. All the diaspora from all around the world will return to Israel. In verse 20, and the captivity of this host of the children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites, even unto Zarephath, and the captivity of Jerusalem, which is up Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south. The references to Canaanites there is probably not just literal Canaan, the land of Canaan, but probably reference to the nations in general. Remember that verse in Zechariah 14, and in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. So the Canaanite in that verse is referring to, you know, the pagan nations around them that won't exist anymore, because only righteousness will exist. And so in this verse it's probably talking more not just the literal Canaanites, but those nations. So Israel will possess more nations than just Israel. And although Zarephath was the widow of Zarephath, which as a city was kind of north, like in Lebanon, it's also interesting that in modern Hebrew, this is Zarephath in Hebrew, and that's taken modern Hebrew to mean France, and Sepharad is modern Spain in modern Hebrew. So an Israeli would look at this and say, you know, even unto France and unto Spain. And there might be more in that than we realise. It might just not be only be literal cities and, you know, greater Israel. It might also be that those nations that Israel fight through will be so conquered, you know, France and Spain and Germany, they are the very countries that are confederate against Israel. So possibly it's meaning the nations in general, you know, for several reasons. Verse 21, and saviours shall come up in Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be Yahweh's. And so us, the saviours, we are the ones who will come up to Mount Zion to enter into Jerusalem and to start judging the nations that stand against Israel, and the kingdom will then be delivered to the saints. So those last few verses in Obadiah are sort of very quick sort of potted history of all the events that will happen in the latter day confederacy, you know, the modern day Edom, not the Arabs, but rather those nations that will stand against Israel, will be destroyed, completely and utterly overwhelmed by Israel and by the saints, and God will return all that bitter hatred that they've had over the years, return upon their own head. So the exhortation for us is that this will very shortly come to pass. We're just waiting for Christ to return and set all these events in motion. You know, we are the saints, we are the saviours that will come up from Mount Zion. We'll be resurrected if we're dead by that time or made immortal. We'll personally take part in these events. You know, these won't just be studies that we come to now and again. These will actually be events that we personally will be reading. We'll be doing the things written herein. We've got to keep our lamps burning, our lamps trimmed, our oil ready. We have to have a plentiful supply of oil to really understand these things, to want to take part in these things, and to be excited that very shortly we're going to be taking part in these scriptures, fulfilling scripture ourselves, not just reading about something that's going to happen in the future. Our hearts have to burn within us when we consider these things. We have to get excited at these things, realising just how close they will be when they finally happen. And finally, I'll just read you one verse in Habakkuk that we'll know well, just to show how soon Christ's return will be. It says, chapter 2, verse 3, for the vision is yet for an appointed time, but that end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. In the New Testament, that's "it will not tarry" is translated as Christ, or he will not tarry. So although the vision looks like it's an appointed time, it's, you know, sometime in the future, etc., it will happen. It won't lie, the vision will come to pass. And though right now it does seem to be tarrying, it does seem to be delaying, you know, when is Christ going to return? Just wait patiently for these things to happen, because it will surely come to pass. And we'll look back and think, you know, it didn't tarry, Christ did return at the time appointed. So all we have to do is just remain faithful, keep our lamps trimmed and oil fully in our lamps at all times. And our heart should burn within us when we consider these things, because shortly we are going to be the ones that make these passages come to life. We're going to be actually doing these things that we're reading about. So the vision won't tarry, it will come soon.